tonight on Arena. Poet Enda Wiley shares some seasonal verse, and Eamon Sweeney with his pick of music books from 2024. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. Well, the days are certainly getting shorter and they're certainly getting a bit colder, but the crispness of a winter landscape is hard to beat. A sheen to that low winter sun, strikingly beautiful in my mind if you're out and about and able to enjoy it. We thought we would mark that this particular time of year with a selection of wintry poetry as chosen by poet Enda Wiley, who is with me in studio this evening. And, you know, it's kind of almost counterintuitive, I think, and to say, yeah, the winter's a great time for poems and poetry, because you think, oh, well, surely it's the autumn, or it's the spring, or it's these life-giving moments. But there is something about winter that has a sensibility of poetry about it.
Oh, definitely, most definitely. And I have to praise you on your lyrical introduction there. Oh, yeah.
weeks of writing went into that.
Yeah, well, it's wonderful to be here and to be surrounded by winter poems. You're right, it is a dark season, but it's a great time for poets. They love it. They love hunkering down. They love getting reflective. They love going into the darkness. And I think they're dead right, because judging by the poems that I have here, they've gone into the darkness. They've gone into various themes about life and death and different things like that, but they've come up with the goodies. So I've had great fun. In our house, there have been winter poems all over the place, the dog tripping over them, everyone tripping over them. But I'm here now, and I really, it's been tricky enough because I have to say there are loads and loads of amazing winter poems out there. But I decided to stick with the Irish poets.
Fair enough.
Very loyal to them. And I went to my poets that I really thought would come up with the goodies, and they did. So I was really happy with what I found. I mean, there are poems of, as I said, heartache, but also great joy as well. So going into the darkness brings out light. Yeah, and I suppose poets are waiting for the solstice to come and then light to come. And it's all about that, isn't it?
The days will be on the turn before we know
they
it.
They will indeed, Sean.
Now, you're going to start with a love poem, a winter love poem. And this is a translation from Derek Mahon.
It is indeed. And I just love the idea as well that it's anonymous. The mystery of the anonymous poet. You know, there's been a long tradition of it.
17th century anonymous as well.
This is, yeah, indeed. And also there's drink in it, there's love in it, and there's also Slow Blossom, which is really beautiful. It's a tiny little poem, and I just think it packs a punch. And Derek Mahon himself said that he was drawn to the idle intensity of doodles when he was doing these translations. They're from a book called Adaptations. Gallery Press brought them out into 2006. But I think really there he's being a bit humble, because they're beautiful, his translations. This is sparse, it's fine, it's really beautiful. So I'm going to give you this poem now, called Folk Song from the 17th century, Irish Anonymous, translated by Derek Mahon. 100 men imagine love when I drink wine, and then I begin to think of your words and mine. The hills are silent now under a white rush of snow, and my love like slow blossom on a blackthorn bush.
There you go. Folk Song by Derek Mahon from Adaptations, 2006 publication from the Gallery Press. Enda Wiley with her selection of wintry poems. It's amazing what he packs into 8 lines, isn't it? But even you were saying that he talked about the idle intensity of doodles.
I know.
Only a poet could.
I know,
yeah,
exactly.
When I'm scribbling around, I come up with things.
Yeah. I think when he says as well, the white rush of snow, that's, I think, when you know you're in the company of a really great poet, you know, and That really, you know, tugged at my heart there. So it became the poem that I first wanted to
read. Yeah, and snow at the beginning of that line, and then at the end of the line, hyphenated and carrying into the next line, slow blossom. And that's, it's right, a slow blossom, S-L-O-E blossom.
Yeah.
So a lovely sound rhyme, perfect. But visually, it has a slightly different look about it, which is very interesting indeed. I wouldn't have thought we'd be going to Seville for oranges in the middle of winter, but that's where Kerry Hardy brings us.
It's true. And actually, it was funny because all the poems I chose, they began to rub off each other and they began to lead me onto something else. So I went from Slow Blossom to Oranges. So Kerry Hardy, this, I think that her book that she brought out this year, We Go On from Blood Axe, is one of the finest collections. I really loved it. She is a poet that really goes dark and meditative. But this poem is full of a strange kind of imaginative joy as well. We're in a freezing winter classroom. I think many of us can relate to that. And the teacher starts divvying out oranges. And of course, I mean, Kerry, the poet, or maybe the narrator of the poem, is there, and she gobbles the poem up, and then something magical and imaginative happens. I don't want to give it away until I read the poem. But will I read it for you, Sean? Would
please
you like
do,
to hear
please
it?
Do,
okay.
Yeah.
When Oranges Were Spanish by Kerry Hardy. Morning in the winter classroom, an orange divided, handed round, and children spitting pips on wooden desks. Not me. I swallow mine. The teacher grabs my arm, shakes hard. She swears they'll sprout inside me. I will be a tree. I look. Already there is a new bark on my wrists. Fresh twigs are bursting from my stiffening hands. My flesh begins to flutter in a shift of leaves. Oh, joyousness. This stepping out from my hot sausage skin of humanness, tight packed with organs, blood and veins. Minute by minute, I grow stronger, greener, till I am a tree, and tree is me, and all the room perfumed by orange blossom, Easter, far Seville, till vision dims, becomes reality of damp wool, chilblain itch. Yet still, the faintest tang of citrus hums the air.
Absolutely brilliant stuff. That's Where Oranges Were Spanish from Kerry Hardy. That's from the recent collection, We Go On, which has a touch of a Beckett in the title of it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
We Go On. It's published by Blood Axe Books earlier this year. And Wylie has chosen the poems for us. There is something beautiful in that. It reminds me of that, you know, that Jim Croce song about the kid who's drawing flowers in all sorts of colours, and the teacher says, no, they're only red and green. Don't be messing about with that's the colour that they always needed to be. There's a touch of that when the child takes the seed in and goes, and you read it beautifully, I will be a tree. I could hear a child's voice.
Yeah.
It's almost as if that's the moment at which a poet could have been born within Kerry Hardy. That's what it feels like,
yeah,
it sounds
that's
like.
That's so true. And there's a wonderful blossoming in that poem. And I love the feistiness of her voice as well. She really gets into the mind of the child, doesn't she?
Yeah. But then at the end...
Oh, we're back to reality, aren't we?
Reality bites. Geometry and algebra are on the way, clearly after lunchtime in that particular school.
And those chilblains.
Yeah, no. She does take us back down to earth.
Yeah,
it's not all romantic in the middle of winter. Let's
be honest. Definitely not.
Paula Meehan, and this time of year, it strikes me. Yeah, we celebrate and we enjoy ourselves, and it is a good time to kind of get ready for the new year and all of that type of thing. But it can be a time when people feel terrible pressures, either financial or even emotional, where they feel, I have to be happy because I'm told I have to be happy.
I know, yeah. And it's so true. And that's why, actually, I chose this poem, My Father's Hands, that winter by Paula Meehan. And it's from her selected poems called As If by Magic. And I do think she's a magician poet because she uses memory so tenderly. She's back in, you know, the area where she grew up in the inner city. Mm. And she's imaginatively remembering her father and how he was an amazing man, really, because he was out of work and he took up a 14-hour day job plucking turkeys. And she really gets, we were talking about chilblains earlier, but the cold and the hardship of it. But also it's a poem that is, as I said, very tender. It's full of love. She's written so tenderly about her family, her mother, her father, grandparents. And this poem, I just went to it and I felt it's a perfect one to read on a cold winter's night. And to think, as you said, of people who have it hard, who have it difficult at Christmas time.
Yeah.
So I'll read an excerpt of it because it is quite a long poem. It begins, "That year there was cold like no other winter. I remember my father's hands so clearly. He was out of work. It must have been through desperation on the cusp of Christmas that he took a job in cartons as a turkey plucker. For buttons, he said. And I saw a frock like the girls in the storybook, all fuddy-duddy in ribbons and flounces, with black patent shoes. His hands were swollen, scratched raw and bloody from the sharp ends of feather, of sinew, of tendon, from the 14-hour day, from the bite of the boss. At the window I'd watch each morning, impatient for dawn and ice engineering. He'd boil up a big pot of eggs, school lunch for us children. He'd button down the younger ones' coats gingerly and tie up the laces of their shoes and tuck in our scarves at our delicate throats. An egg in each pocket to keep us warm. Old socks on our hands to guard against chilblains. A kiss on his forehead to keep him from harm. And then I just love the poem leads to the final four lines where she says, I could hold in mind forever now my father's hands that winter and the city walls and railings freaked with snow.
God, it's deeply moving, isn't it?
That, so that beautiful, poem.
That's
isn't
Paula
it?
Meehan's, an excerpt from Paula Meehan's My Father's Hands That Winter, and that is from the collection As If By Magic and Selected Poems, the kind of two aspects to that recent collection published by Daedalus Press. I love where it, you think, oh, he's going to give them the little kiss on the forehead to keep them safe during the day.
Yeah.
But it's turned on its head. He seeks the kiss from the children.
That's right.
On his forehead.
A kiss on his forehead. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
And also, I love the eggs because they come in like winter blessings. And I think that every poem is an act of discovery. A poem takes you on a journey that you, sometimes you don't expect it's going to take you to where it does. And that's the mystery and the wonder of poems.
And the other thing that is beautiful about that poem is the domesticity of it, because we would all often associate the domesticity with the mother and the children.
Yeah.
But here it was the father, despite the fact that he was going out to what sounds like terribly difficult physical work. I've never plucked a turkey, but I'm quite sure you have to really know what you're doing, or else you do have very sore hands.
Yeah, the hardship
at the end of it all.
The desperation, you can really feel it, can't you? But it's warmed by love, isn't it, really, that poem?
So it's full of love.
Perfect.
It is full of love. There's no question about that. Just incidentally, in a house of poets as you and Peter Sir are, do you have seasonal reads, as it were? Come springtime, do all the winter books go up to the attic and all the spring books come down?
Oh my God, they do not. The house is just...
It's just a mess of books.
Creatures all over the place, the books, you know. But I suppose if we're looking for something like now, it's kind of handy that I do have my private library of poetry books that I can go into and rummage and find. But no, definitely we share poems and we talk about poems. And it's fun because sometimes, you know, if Peter finds a poem, it might be left on the table for breakfast. Isn't that nice?
All right, a little gift at breakfast time.
Yeah.
So in those terms, I guess it depends on the day. Sometimes in the middle of the winter, you might be seeking a summer poem just to warm yourself
for
up.
For a bit of light. Like the Kerry Hardy poem, wasn't it? Lovely to go to Seville there.
Yeah,
it is true. We often do that, actually, yeah.
All right. This is another poem looking a bit at the darker side of winter. I think, again, Sarah Berkeley is an interesting choice here for you. She grew up in Dublin, but she now lives in upstate New York. And her work as a hospice nurse, I think that work, or certainly the empathy of that work, is all over this poem.
Yeah, I know. Isn't it such an interesting thing? She's a hospice nurse, also a poet. And I think that she really understands, as a result, human vulnerability. And I think this poem, we were talking about love in the last poem, but this poem is really defiant. It's angry. She's furious, you know, that people have it hard at Christmas. Mm. And she's going to speak out, and she's declaiming it, you know. In the old bardic tradition, poets would stand up and declaim. And I really feel Sarah Berkeley is doing this here. Also, I've always loved her poetry. Like, she was originally published by Dermot Bulger with Raven Arts Press when she was only a teenager in the 80s. And, you know, we were talking about resilience and endurance. And I think that poets, that she's a poet who has kept going, kept publishing. And there she is in upstate New York, still publishing. Actually, this poem is from a new collection by Wake Forest Press called Some of the Things I've Seen. But it was originally published by Gallery here in Ireland. And the title was The Last Cold Day. And I think that's what drew me to it. I went, I'll go and find that book, The Last Cold Day. But it's also published just now, if anyone's looking for it, as a new edition. But it's called Rudolph, and she's, as I said, quite defiantly playing on that idea of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And she's just saying, listen, you have to read this poem, because basically what I'm saying is life can be hard for people at Christmas time. Dermot Bulger has talked about her poise and sharply minted clarity. And I think this poem has that. It's very clear, poised. And also she's got great humanity and grace to her, I think, as a poet. And that's, there is rage, but there is humanity here. So will I read it for you, Sean?
Please do.
Okay, Rudolph by Sarah Berkeley. Consider that it may not be the most wonderful time of year. Consider that the night may not be holy, but full of rage and fear and promises that this will never reoccur, never be this loud again, never go this far. We are round the other side of our brightest star. The short days start with jewels of frost and end with tears. The icicle lights are strung from fear to fear. And in between Rudolph and your nose so bright, won't you guide our flight tonight? The way is barred, the shadow tall, our rage is huge and we are small.
That's Rudolph by Sarah Berkeley from her new collection, Some of the Things I've Seen. And you were saying, Enda Wiley, beforehand, it's published by Wake Forest Press just recently.
That's
but
right.
It does exist. Is it just this poem or the poems in the collection? The collection itself previously
existed? Yeah, the collection itself, was originally called The Last Cold Day, and it's published by Gallery Press, actually.
Yeah, so that was
And I think it won the Yeats Society Poetry Prize back in 2022, which is very good as well.
And it is interesting because sometimes, you know, she manages to rail at some things there, but she brings in the idea of maybe the night isn't holy, or, you know, Rudolph with your nose and your nose so bright.
Yeah.
She doesn't become a Christmas Grinch in the middle of all of that. She's still holding on to the upside of this time of year.
Yeah, that's right. She is. So it's kind of a balance, isn't it? It's a very fine balancing act, but she brings it off, doesn't she? And I just think it's one of those, it stands out, doesn't it? It reminds us that we have to think of others and we have to have empathy. And I think that's one of the great qualities that poets have. I'm standing up for the poets tonight, aren't I?
On that subject of, you know, I talked a little bit earlier about what do you read at this time of year?
Yeah.
Do you find yourself reading more winter poems? Obviously, you did it for this particular exercise, as it were. You were looking for winter poems. In terms of writing, does winter beget winter poems, or how does that work?
I think winter begets poems. I think it's a great time to huddle down, you know, and to write and to reconsider your life and the year that's gone by and the people you've lost, perhaps sadly. Or it's a time of reflection, isn't it? And meditation. And I find that I am writing more in winter time when
it's darker. So
you're
more productive in the winter period.
Summer's for going out and experiencing things, and then winter's for sitting down and
thinking about them and writing about them.
Yeah, getting the notebooks out and turning the scribbles into poems.
What it was called, recollections in calm
tranquility.
Yeah,
exactly.
There you go. So that's what you do in the winter time about your summertime walks. Let us go then to, we're talking about Wordsworth and being out among the walking among nature. Moya Cannon here brings us into the natural world. For me, the natural world, the wintertime natural world, I've always loved the winter sky, the bareness of the trees, those black silhouettes against the horizon. Yeah. I find something almost more beautiful in that than the blossom of winter or the hope of spring.
Yeah, that's interesting. So there is a poet in you, Sean.
Somewhere.
But Moya Cannon, I mean, I think this is a really beautiful poem. It's called Bees Under Snow, and it's from her collected poems from Carcanet Press. It came out in 2015. But it's a poem that I love to read. I actually do read it around this time of year. And I mean, I think Seamus Heaney said that poets are custodians of the unlooked for. And in a way, Moya's here. She's tramping through a field in France. She doesn't say that in the poem, but I had the luxury of meeting her the other day and I did ask her. Where were you when you wrote that poem, Bees Under Snow? And she said she was in eastern France in a valley beside a blackwood, and she suddenly noticed that under the snow there were 52 beehives, and the bees are, again, that word enduring.
But they built them, or the snow came on top of them?
They're built there and the snow is over them.
And I guess they know that that's going to give them a certain type of insulation.
Yeah, well, they're covered in snow and they're trying their best. In this poem, they're really trying their best to do their work, but they're shivering and they're freezing.
Oh, so they're cold.
And so again, it's about it's going back really to Kerry Harding and the idea that we'll go on as humans, but the bees are also trying to do their work, you know. Yeah. And so she's a fantastic poet of nature, I think. I mean, she grew up in Dunfanaghy in Donegal near, you know, the sea and mountains. And I think nature is really part of her makeup as a poet.
Let's hear it then.
Yeah.
Bees Under Snow by Maya.
Bees Under Snow. In a valley beside the Blackwood, this year there are 52 beehives, orange and blue cubes with zinc lids raised on long girders. Last winter, under a foot of snow, they were square marshmallows in a white field. By a minuscule door lay a few dead bees, and one or two flew about distractedly. But the bees inside hovered in a great ball, shivering to keep warm, to stay alive, moving always inwards towards the globe's centre, or outward towards the surface. As much as their hunt for sweetness or their incidental work, fertilising the world's scented myriad-coloured flowers to bear fruit for all earthbound, airborne creatures, this is part of their lives, these long months of shivering of bee faith.
Lovely the way she personalises them, or brings them to life for us as little individuals as opposed to just a big hive of them.
Yeah, hard working and the bee faith. Yeah. So we have to keep the bee faith this winter.
And we should never forget the incidental work, as she refers to it there, you know, basically providing us with all the plants and
I know, exactly. And
flowers, etc., that are on this planet. Bees Under Snow by Moya Cannon, from Collected Poems, published by Carcanet Press in 2015. And finally, interestingly enough, we were speaking about John Montagu just the other night, and the new biography, as Miriam Ali was on talking to us about it, in fact, A Poet's Life, written by Adrian Fraser. So we reviewed it last Wednesday, and you've gone in to a winter poem about in place, really. We're going to place with this poem as you finish up for Ascenda.
Yeah, that's right. So I've gone to John Montagu, and actually it was the biography, A Poet's Life, that brought me back to him. He's a poet that I think is very fine. There's beautiful place names in this. He's in Garvaghy, where he grew up as a child, and it's from the Rough Field. And he himself said that love is the charge behind the lyric. And I think, a bit like Paul Amin and all the poets that we've heard tonight, it's basically an act of love, this poem, to the place. And it's Christmas morning, the crossing fields. So it's not quite Christmas yet, but I thought it'd be a lovely one to end on.
We're nearly there.
So here we go. Christmas Morning by John Montagu. Lights outline a hill as silently the people, like shepherd and angel on that first morning, march from Altclockfin, Beltany, Rareogan, under rhymed hawthorn, Gothic, evergreen, grouped in the warmth cloud of their breath, along cattle paths crusted with ice, tarred roads to this grey country chapel, where a gas lamp hisses to light the crib, under the crossbeam's damp flaked message, Gloria in excelsis.
And O'Wiley there reading Christmas Morning by John Montagu from his new Collected Poems, published in 2012 and published by the Gallery Press. I hope you enjoyed picking them as much as I enjoyed listening to them, Enda, because there's just a beautiful, beautiful little half dozen eggs for us there.
Yeah,
Christmas
lovely.
Eggs, we can call them, we can refer them to. Have a great Christmas. Best of luck with the writing,
since this is
your productive time of year. And I'm sure we'll be speaking to you at some stage in 2025.
Thanks very much, Sean.
Now, festive season draws ever closer. Times to start thinking, I suppose, about the perfect gifts this time or tonight, at any rate, for the music lover or lovers in your life. Maybe just treat yourself to enjoy a book by the fire if you are so inclined. This year certainly has been a good one for music publishing. Range of books that dive into the lives, sounds and stories of some of the most fascinating artists and movements in music. Intimate memoirs, behind the scenes chronicles, cultural deep dives. The books that we have for you this evening, I think, are that Eamon Sweeney has chosen for us, will offer something for everyone, whether you're into Britpop, synth pop, indie legends, or Riot Girl pioneers. Have you all of them in here, Eamon Sweeney? I think you might have.
Yeah, I've shoehorned a fair bit in, I think.
Well, I'm sure you didn't shoehorn. I'm sure you placed it elegantly on
curated.
This.
Curated. Yes. That's the buzzword now, isn't it? Like, not you, shows and it's curated.
Yes,
yeah.
So you have curated a wish list of yeah. books for us. Let's start with... I'm saying this is your first recommendation, and I don't know if these are necessarily in order of preference or just this was the first one you wrote down. Street Level Superstar, A Year with Lawrence by Will Hodgkinson. You have to be very important to call yourself just Lawrence. Like, I couldn't
Absolutely,
be around just
yeah.
calling myself Sean.
Yeah, no, this guy calls, you know, like Sting or Adele. Yeah. Anonymous. It's known this way. He's a kind of a cult hero for many that formed a band called Felt in 1979. And it was basically the manifestation of a childhood manifesto that he had dreamt up of. In the space of 10 years, I'm going to release 10 albums and 10 singles, which he did.
Wow.
He followed that dream. And the results are, you know, Primitive Painters would be a song that maybe some listeners would know, featuring Liz Phaser from the Cocteau Twins, which is absolutely awesome track.
Well, you know what? I'll bring it in a little bit underneath this. Why is this so, I suppose this is... This signals who, what's his name, Lawrence yeah. actually was, and particularly who Felt were. His big long introduction. So give us a little bit of sense of how this typifies what he and Felt did.
They basically were kind of accredited. Johnny Marr from the Smiths accredited them of basically being the fathers of guitar pop, of indie alternative guitar pop. And of course, the Smiths took that baton and yeah. went somewhere completely with it and basically became household names and topped the charts, all that. Felt obviously didn't, but laid the groundwork. People like Jarvis Cocker, Belle Sebastian, all these people.
The list goes on and on. Okay,
yeah.
So without this particular song that we're going to listen to, people like the Smiths might never have existed. There you go, Primitive Painters, 1985 track from Felt, and we're just playing a little bit of that for you because we're speaking tonight with Eamon Sweeney about the great music books of 2024, and the first one he's talking to us about is Level Superstar, A Year with Lawrence by Will Hodgkinson. We were saying as we were listening to that, Eamon, you certainly can hear where the Smiths came out of that in
Absolutely.
Both the guitar and the vocals. But that, when Alison Fraser of Cocteau Twins comes in, that female vocal brings it to a whole new place, in fact, doesn't
it? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It is an absolutely astounding track.
Yeah.
Like, really is like a stone cold classic.
Okay, well, let's talk about what Will Hodgkinson gives us in this book about Lawrence then.
This is where this book, what makes it so fascinating and so interesting, that it kind of is a warts and all beginning of the project, the negotiation with Lawrence, and these list of demands. This is not your conventional, you know, ghostwritten biography.
He manifested this manifesto himself.
Yeah, absolutely.
As a child.
And, you know, he does say kind of early on, you cannot reveal my surname. That's kind of a big one, even though a cursory internet search probably will. Secondly, do not tell any anecdotes. I hate all these kind of things of, oh, I saved my band from a car crash on the M1 and I'm a hero. I don't want that. Do not use the word just. Or why not? Just because I hate it. And I suppose you could say this guy is slightly eccentric, but there's no judgment on that. And there's no, the way he behaves, and they basically walk around these very strange districts in North London, and it's very much a bit exercise in psychogeography as well, and you do actually feel like you're actually walking around.
So it's a series of conversations almost between Hodgkins and Hodgkin
and Lawrence. And then he tracks down former band members, ex-girlfriends. It's very, very weird and wonderful.
Lawrence did have his own battles, though, with homelessness, with addiction and with mental health. Is that dealt with in the book, or how is that
absolutely,
handled?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, I think it's dealt with with great sensitivity and respect. And he is essentially penniless. Like, there is one scene where he asks Hodgkin to help him to go to the bank, bringing these sacks of 2p coins. And he gets notes of £37 sterling 50. And he's absolutely delighted. He's absolutely thrilled. Yeah. But I think really what this book is, as a kind of a testament to resilience. And he at one stage he says that no matter how many times the police break down my door to check that I'm still alive, what comforts me is that I know that I'm an artist. And I've been an artist and I'll be an artist forever.
Clearly, driven by a real inner belief, even if that has caused him its troubles in its time. Street Level Superstar: A Year with Lawrence is the title of that book, and the author is Will Hodgkinson. Let's move on to book number two. Actually, we spoke with Miranda Sawyer about this book, Uncommon People, Britpop and Beyond in 20 Songs. I said it to her on the night I spoke to her, it's such a misleading title because it's way more than Britpop and 20 Songs.
Absolutely.
The Beyond bit really is what gives us a sense of what she's doing in this book. It's a big cultural, big social history.
Absolutely. The songs really just become a hook to get into the social history and to the cultural commentary. Like, one of the strongest chapters, even though I would dispute the choice of song itself, it actually doesn't really matter, is about Ash. And it goes into the Good Friday Agreement, and it goes into how Belfast transformed partly due to culture and music, and does this with numerous other British cities and British artists, and just people from different backgrounds, different genders, different genres, rather than this monolith of white Blur versus Oasis and blokey kind of beery pop. That it's kind of a reminder that time is so much more vibrant and a lot more eclectic than it's given.
And you were saying you might question the choice of Ash song, and I'm sure if you went through any of the other 20 songs that were there, people might question, well, where is this song or where is that band? But as she said to me on the night we spoke, it wasn't about that. It was what you just said. She chose a song that would open up a story for her.
Yes,
really.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How important are artists like PJ Harvey and Tricky in the midst of this book?
They really kind of stand out because they would actually be two of the best choices, I think, in terms of song as well. As such singular personalities, the chapter on Tricky is, just reminds us of just how out there that he was, and how PJ Harvey kind of like, as a performer, she kind of completely bucked the trend and reinvented herself in this amazing way and brought this incredible look to Glastonbury in the mid-90s. And it's just kind of a reminder of, oh, great, it wasn't just all about Damon Albarn and the Gallagher brothers. There was all these kind of like amazing, crazy kind of characters making amazing music.
And people that are the music that you wouldn't necessarily think of as Britpop. Uncommon People, Britpop and Beyond in 20 Songs by Miranda Sawyer. Let's move on then to another set of brothers. This is Never Understood the Jesus and Mary Chain by Jim and William Reid, the brothers in question, with Ben Thompson. How is this story of, I don't know how you describe that brotherly relationship between the two Reeds. How is it done? Do we know when it's Jim talking? Do we know when it's William talking? Is it clear?
It's absolutely crystal clear. It's kind of like each section of the book is Jim, William, Jim, William. And they can directly contradict each other. Mm. And it's almost feel like they're kind of arguing with each other, even though if the other one isn't there. And they live, continents apart at this stage, but obviously get on well enough to do this and also to tour as the Jesus and Mary Chain.
And what's Ben Thompson's role within all of this? Is this a curated set of interviews or conversations?
He's very much the ghostwriter. And what I find it, there's a very strong narrative to it, a great coherency to it. And I suppose this, with the subject matter, often with music memoirs, it can be just too much about the childhood. It's like, oh, God, it stops. But because of these guys, and what they became. It's just perfect. It just and it ties in to themes and lyrics later on and rows that might have had. And if very much, sometimes you actually feel you're in a transit van
with them,
like with them, and just seeing like a row breaking out. It's very candid and very, very funny as well.
Let's have a listen to a little bit of Just Like Honey. Just Like Honey, a 1985 track from the Jesus and Mary Chain, and this in connection with the book we're talking about, Never Understood, the Jesus and Mary Chain, Jim and William Reid with Ben Thompson. I suppose that the beginning of the title does beg the question, Never Understood. They were often referred to as being arrogant and, you know, kind of talking down at people. Do we get some sense of, you know, I'm terribly misunderstood, I'm actually very vulnerable and shy behind all of that?
Yeah, we do get that. And we do get a sense of their Scottish childhood in East Kilbride, which is kind of one of those a new town that was constructed outside Glasgow, that men in particular hid behind belligerence, lots of alcohol, and that everything that the Jesus and Mary Chain kind of became was really because of a consequence of that, of not being able to communicate properly with each other, with the world, and add alcohol and addiction and a bit of sibling rivalry. It really was kind of like a potent cocktail that also produced some extraordinary music.
Yeah, well, I was going to say it produced great music, but you also suddenly have made me feel sorry for them in a way perhaps I haven't done before. Let's move on to, let me give Never Understood, the Jesus and Mary Chain by Jim and William Reid with Ben Thompson, the title of that. Bedsit Land, the Strange Worlds of Soft Cell by Patricia Clarke.
Patrick Clarke. This is the first book of the British Pop Archive from Manchester University Press. Now, that might sound kind of very highfalutin.
I'm kind of thinking, academic.
No, it's not. It's a beautiful, published straight to paperback, beautiful pink edition, quite short, very readable, an oral history. Patrick Clarke is the deputy editor of The Quietest, which is an amazing website. Amazing social history, amazing insight into the background of the band, the different strange worlds that they inhabited in, growing up in these kind of seaside towns of Blackpool and Southport, that leads then, and that club scene becomes the first other strange world that they inhabit that kind of creates all this amazing music. Going into Soho, London, going to New York, post-Franco Spain. It's like this kind of world tour. And it sums up all the kind of chaos of it.
And it's a kind of an oral history, so it's told as in conversations and interviews with people. That's how we get this story of Soft Cell told to us.
Yes, primarily with the duo themselves, with Mark Almond and Dave Ball, but all sorts of people like Hugh Feather, who'd be like a childhood friend of Almond's, who kind of defined that kind of neo-lish, seedy aesthetic of Soft Cell, and you know, just so much, and the art movements and what that was inspired from. And also Clark's just commentary throughout is that it's not, Dylan Jones used to does oral history amazingly well in his books about Bowie in the 80s and 90s and so on. And this is, you know, I think equally if not better in terms of something so readable and so engrossing, so intelligent, but like extremely accessible.
All right. And it is called Bedsitland, The Strange Worlds of Soft Cell by Patrick Clark. A couple of honourable mentions that you wanted to have before we finished up.
Based on extracts that I've reading from Cher, the memoir part one, even though it's this huge doorstepper of a book, the extracts that
you've read so far,
Vulture magazine published, it's absolutely fascinating. Like really
well
written.
I heard Graham Norton manfully trying to interview her the other night, and she was, you know, she was making fun of it, of course, but she was giving one word answers.
Yeah,
does she tell? From what you've read, is she
from
telling?
What I've read, she's really kind of spitting the beans. She talks about the first meeting with Sonny Bono, and about the amount of lies that he said that he was kind of claimed to be a descendant of Napoleon Bonaparte. Sounds like there's more red flags than a Liverpool or Shells match or something going on. But yeah, it does seem, now my only trepidation is when I see part one, I go,
oh no,
really?
How many more parts are to go?
Do we need that? You know, with the honourable exception of Brett Anderson, I've generally found the two-part thing a bit clunky. But based on what I've read so far, that's something that I'd like to maybe...
All right. Okay, so we'll keep an eye out for that. And one other, or two others, I think you
want to... Rebel Girl by Life It's a Feminist Punk by Kathleen Hanna.
Yeah.
The original Riot Girl Firebrand, married Ad Rock from the Beastie Boys. She was confronting sexism and assault in the 80s and the 90s, and very much a precursor to the Me Too movement, and very fascinating figure, and that is a cracking book
and a little venue for us.
Yeah, Volume Records and Books is a newish shop on 75 York Road, Dunleary, adjacent to the Board and Brood Cafe. Also, I was just popping in there yesterday. They've obtained a wine license, stocking a fine selection of organic wine.
But you can listen to lots of live music, and they're specialists in vinyls.
Yeah, and books. One of the best.
So if you're going for books, maybe go to the local bookshop. This being an example of just that.
Good new independent.
Buy it there if at all possible. Eamon, thanks for your choices. Happy Christmas to you and yours. You can listen back to Eamon's recommendations, obviously, on our podcast after the show. You'll get all of the details there. Now, cast your mind back to one of literature's, and indeed film's, great love stories. Newly arrived tourists in Florence, Lucy Honeychurch and her chaperone Charlotte Bartlett, bemoan the lack of a room with a view. That is until the Emerson father and son make an offer they too quickly refuse.
Your mother would never forgive me if I took the view.
Mother would want you to have it.
On no account, the view of the Arno is yours.
I don't know why we're arguing, because we don't have it. We have no view.
I have a view. I have a view, so does George. My son George here. You can have our rooms, and we'll have yours. We can change. But why shouldn't you have them?
Thank you very much indeed. We could not impose on your kindness.
Why?
You see, we wouldn't...
Hush, Lucy.
Women like looking at a view. Men don't. George, persuade them.
It's obvious they should have the rooms. There's nothing else to say.
Signora?
No, thank you.
Why shouldn't you change? We can clear out in half an hour, 15 minutes. It's ridiculous, these niceties. They go against common sense. Every kind of sense. I don't care what I see outside. My vision is within. Here is where the birds sing. Here is where the sky is blue.
Come, Lucy.
Let them have their view if they want it. Why shouldn't they if they want it? George, go after them.
What an impossible person.
Maggie Smith, the final voice you heard there. Denham Elliott in absolutely brilliant form.
You should have won an Oscar for that.
As the dad. You also heard Helena Bonham Carter as the aforementioned Lucy Honeychurch and Julian Sands. Oh, he's going to fall so badly enough. It's going to hurt him, isn't it? This Merchant Ivory's adaptation of E.M.M. Forrester's Room with a View. The new documentary looks at one of the most enduring partnerships in film history, known as Merchant Ivory. But of course, there was a lot more involved in it than just director James Ivory and producer Ishmael Merchant. Add to this the writer, Ruth Prower Yabvala and composer Richard Robbins, and you have a recipe for some of the most loved films in the 1980s and 1990s, directed by Stephen Soucy. The documentary is simply called Merchant Ivory, and it looks back on the partnership and the great films they made together. Morris, Room with a View, Howard's End, The Remains of the Day, and Call Me By Your Name, to name just one of the 43 films, I think, we're told at the beginning of the, yes, of the documentary that they made together. Paul Whittington, as you can hear in the background there, has been watching it for us, and he's with me in studio now. Now, I've already heard people, oh, here we go, Merchant Ivory, 1980s, yeah, 1990s, chocolate box,
yeah,
frock films, all they were, as Emma Thompson says, they were dismissed as period dramas.
They were.
And people say, oh, it's just, it's all surface, all style, no substance.
Yeah, there's a very famous, Alan Parker had a sideline in satirical cartoons, and he called it the Laura Ashley School of Filmmaking, which is very funny, but entirely misses the point, because they sort of looked like, you know, they were suspiciously not working class. And the films they're most famous for, although they made loads of films that weren't period dramas, and they started by making a series of Indian films, the first of the second of which, Shakespeare Wala, was the one that kind of put them on the map in the art house world. But in the late 70s, James Ivory and Ishmael Merchant, who were quite, they were a couple in real life. They were an extraordinary pair. They achieved a great deal. And their film sets, they were a bit like a duck, very calm on the surface and flapping around underwater, people not getting paid, Merchant cooking these giant meals for everybody to mollify them.
Mightn't pay you, but I'll give you a great curry.
I'll give you a great curry.
Each day on the shoot.
Yeah, one of their friends in this film said, you never went to sleep at night without dreaming of ways to kill him, but you could not love him. So you had these amazing characters. In the late 70s, they started adapting the novels, first of Henry James, The Europeans, and then of E.M. Forster. And they hit upon a real, and Ruth Prior-Javala was writing them and was a beautiful screenwriter. And they hit on this very rich stream. And they weren't just pretty costume drama. What does costume drama mean anyway?
Yeah, that's what Emma Thompson says. Sure, everything was a costume drama. Yeah. Everything's a period drama.
Yeah, you know? But underneath there was all this tremendous kind of sexual tension, psychological drama. And there was the point also that when stories are liberated from the present, it was easier to see what was going on.
And interesting, sense. I mean, obviously they weren't the first to bring books to the screen, but they seemed to do something with, excuse me, the book to screen, that particular challenge. They did something with that because, you know, these are big romantic, in lots of cases, romantic novels, but with real delicacy and nuance underneath them.
Yeah,
and they were able to manage to get that onto the screen?
They were absolutely able to find that. David Lean, who was very good at making epics, made them so expensive and shot them over such periods of time that they put everybody off them. And in fact, they'd fallen rather out of fashion. And then, as you suggested at the start, particularly in the mid 80s to mid 90s, they started a kind of a craze for them, and they remained at the centre of that. And it was a kind of event. I'm not just in the UK, and they did well in Europe and America. A Merchant Ivory film was an event. What would it be? It would always be beautifully written. It would always look tremendous, suspectly tremendous from some people's point of view, but it always did. And then you got these
the
brilliant
casting.
They were
using.
Yeah,
and the casting
actors they found.
Yeah, it was Hugh Grant's big break into Morris was his big break into film. He was kind of giving it all up at that point.
Yeah, he's very funny as always in interviews. He said, I'd kind of given up on acting. Then he'd started doing comic writing with a friend of his brother, said, do not turn this film
down. His agent, he said, I never heard from the agent. Then he said, I don't want to see you for this thing. Do you want to go first?
Yeah. And in fact, to Alan Parker's, you know, not to pick on him, a lot of people were dismissive of them. But like that film, Morris, for instance, like I remember when that came out in 1987. And that was at a very febrile time. The AIDS crisis was happening. Thatcher's government was just about to bring in Section 28, and this was a film that openly depicted a sort of thwarted gay Edwardian relationship, and it was considered very controversial in its time.
And when you hear that Thatcher statement, but you know, people feel they have a moral right to stand up.
Yeah,
and that they've some kind of right to stand up and be considered gay, I think, is the term.
Yeah, it was chilling, really.
It's an extraordinary clip when you hear it within the body of the film itself. But what's interesting within all of that, given what Thatcher was doing in terms of Section 28, is the relationship between Merchant and Ivy, Ishmael Merchant. Very different backgrounds.
Yeah.
And in inverted commas, nobody knew they were gay, or certainly they weren't publicising it.
They weren't advertising themselves. No, it was a very different time, and James Ivory was reticent until about it at all until relatively recently. He wrote an autobiography on which this documentary is partly based. But they were very different. He was from Oregon. He had been adopted, which I didn't know. He studied very refined, studied fine arts, then film. Then he began making documentaries, and one of them was, several of them were about India. And he met, he had a fateful meeting at a screening of one of the films in the Indian consulate in New York. He met Ismail Merchant, this wheeler dealer producer from Mumbai. And
he could persuade anybody to do anything.
He absolutely could. Most of the actors interviewed in this do an Ismail Merchant impersonation, which is basically shoot, Jim, shoot, because he was always trying to see, James Ivory was waiting for the perfect shot, and he was worried about wasting money because money in the background was always a problem.
All right, of course, the whole sexuality is dealt with in the film Call Me By Your Name. When you think of the scene that happens here between the young man Elio, played by Timothy Chalamet, he's loved and he's lost his first love, Oliver, during this summer holiday, and he comes home to his father, a Mr. Perelman, played by Michael Stuhlberg. And Ivory, from within the documentary.
At 89, he wins an Oscar for this screenplay.
And he says how different this experience, this fictional experience, was from his own.
I can remember those very same things with my father. The semi-warnings of my father about how his health is perhaps not going to be so great forever. I mean, I had all those kinds of conversations with my father. I never had the conversation with my father that you have at the end of Call Me By Your Name. That's a completely, completely different kind of thing. A different kind of father.
Look, you had a beautiful friendship. Maybe more than a friendship. And I envy you. In my place, most parents would hope the whole thing goes away. Pray their sons land on their feet, but I am not such a parent.
There you go. That's James Ivory himself, and then that scene from Call Me By His Name. When they started, because they started out in the shoestring budgets and kind of paying by curry, as it were.
Yeah.
When they did start to get big budgets, are there those who said that when they had too much money, then maybe the quality of the films fell?
Well, it seemed to. There seemed to be something about that sort of seat of the pants way of doing things that created this sort of brittle brilliance in some of the films. I mean, they're probably their best, certainly their most famous film, The Remains of the Day, which was very unlucky to appear in the same award season as a little film called Schindler's List. So it didn't do eight nominations, no wins. But that was that's a wonderful film.
I want to listen to a little clip, because it's Emma Thompson explaining how she couldn't get into this scene, the famous scene with Anthony Hopkins, where he has the book in his hand, and she couldn't get into it, but then Ivory gave her the perfect direction.
I remember that day very well, because I came in a state of sort of tension. I was heightened, and I came in and we played it a couple of times. And I thought, well, it's quite working. I said, Tony, I'm not getting this. And he said, Tony, he said, it's one of those afternoons where there's a very tired bee buzzing around, or a fly, actually, nothing as romantic as a bee, against the glass, occasionally hitting it. It's a sleepy afternoon. He's reading. You come in. You have no intentions. Relax, and let's see what happens.
Why won't you show me your book?
This is my private time. You're invading it.
Oh, is that so?
Yes.
I'm invading your private time, am I?
Yes.
What's in that book? Come on, let me see.
And then what happens is this extraordinarily sexual, erotic moment where at the end of each take, you know, I felt quite faint. And of course, tone.
It's not scandalous at all. It's just a sentimental old love story.
The way in which he looks, not at her eyes, but her mouth. And then the hand comes down and you think he's going to touch her, but he never does.
I really must ask you, please, not to disturb the few moments I have to pass through.
Actually, it was Tone who gave her the direction,
She was
a perfect actor's note, you see. Yeah. No director would ever come up with a note like that. Which of them is still alive? Ivory, isn't it?
95,
Still working away?
Still writing, still writing.
Worth seeing this opening
for anybody who's interested in these films, or even in cinema generally. It's analogous to Made in England, the Powell and Pressburger film from earlier this year. It's really very, very interesting. And a lot of people won't even know who they are at this stage. Yeah, but, right. They made some great films.
People will be back watching the films again. Christmas is a good time. There'll be some of them on the telly at some point. Paul Whittington speaking to us there about Merchant Ivory, which is the documentary that will be streaming on Curzon Home Cinema from Friday, December the 6th. And that's our lot for this Wednesday evening. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Jamie Doyle was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Kay Sheehy. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.